Okay, good morning, everybody. I guess I should, I'm very grateful to express my gratitude to KITP for giving me the opportunity to be here, which has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that one of the organizers is a collaborator of mine. What I'm going to talk about is in spintronics, you're almost invariably dealing with, for example, transition metals, which have complex electronic structures. And I want to say something about the effect, how you include those electronic structures and combine that with disorder. The formulation we're going to be doing transport calculations. The formulation we're going to use is Landauer-Buttiger because we're interested on the atomic scale. Electrons behave as waves, so we're going to use the Schrödinger equation. We're going to use Landauer-Buttiger formulation. We've got an incoming wave. This is our scattering region here. We have an incoming wave, a reflected wave, a transmitted wave, and in the Landauer-Buttiger formula, then the conductance of this scattering region is given by looking at the transmission here, which in a complex system is multimode, so this is a matrix, squaring it and multiplying it by the fundamental unit of conductance. More generally then, we can look at a scattering theory of electron transport where we have incoming waves from the left and from the right, outgoing waves, and they're related here by a scattering matrix. This was the transmission matrix and reflection matrix we just saw, but of course from the left-hand side you can also get reflection and transmission. And this is just a bit more general, and it allows more applications to make more contact, on one hand with phenomenological theory, and then with more complex experiments. Everything I'm going to talk about is based on a density functional theory. It's first principles, no parameters, which doesn't mean it's exact. It has all the drawbacks of density functional theory for the advantages and disadvantages. What we do is we split our system up, we break it up into layers. We use a atomic orbital basis or a real space grid so that the Hamiltonian splits up into blocks. So we have on-site blocks H here, and we have hopping blocks from the scattering region and in the leads. So, and we choose these layers in such a way that the Cohn-Sham equation of density functional theory splits up into this tri-diagonal form here, where we have the on-site term here, and here we have the hopping terms, which are blocks in general. Now, and we're going to solve then this scattering problem, which is an infinite system. We want to solve the scattering problem at a fixed energy, usually E equal to EF, but we can do it at general energy. So the problem here is that this is an infinite system, idealized, then we've split it up. We've got leads which have perfect translational periodicity. This is a scattering region which is localized in space. And what we're going to do is the usual strategy to solve this is to split it up into two parts. The first thing you do is you look at the ideal lead. You solve that problem using conventional methods of electronic structure theory. And the second bit is now what you have is you have all of the scattering states here. And what you can do is you can impose the boundary condition here in the form of a self-energy, which depends on the energy itself here. So you replace these semi-infinite leads by finite self-energy. You embed the scattering region here, so you have a finite problem to solve. And then you can use it. And the particular way we do this is a generalization of a formulation by Ander wave function matching, where you match the waves. And it can be shown that that's completely equivalent to the Károlyi form, the non-equilibrium Green's function in the response regime. Okay, we've worked on two implementations. One is a tight binding Muffington orbital. That's our basis. It's a minimal basis, but it's a numerical basis, so it's essentially S, P, D, or F, as many orbitals as you want. It's suitable for transition metals, for describing systems which are magnetic with localized orbitals. And it's very efficient when you combine it with the atomic spheres approximation, but that means it's most suitable for close-packed solids. So the atomic sphere approximation is something like the Muffin-Tin approximation, but it's better. but it's a shape, so-called shape approximation. The second implementation is based on real space grid and pseudo potentials, exactly the same formulation of wave function matching, but it isn't restricted as restricted. It uses a full potential. It's more suitable for open structures. So the first one is we use for the tight binding Muffington orbitals, we use for spin transport. And the second formulation we use for molecular electronics, and of course at some stage or other somebody will want to attach transition metal leads to molecules, and you'll have to advance one step, but we're not there yet. Okay. Over the last few years, we've applied it to a whole range of applications. So this Muffington orbital scheme is very versatile. And these are the people who these applications then have been carried out with. And it's been reviewed recently in a paper in Physics Reports, which has appeared a couple of weeks ago. What I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to concentrate here. This audience is probably not familiar with this sort of types of thing I'm talking about. So I'll start off with the first third of the talk going through CPP, current perpendicular to plane, introduce you to the complexities of the transition metals, look at interface resistances, and then I'll say something about recent work on tunneling magnetoresistance, and if there is time, but there probably won't be, on spin injection from a ferromagnet into a semiconductor. Okay. Spin-dependent transmission, these are the actors. Kersha and Maciej Srzycki were postdocs in Twente. He's gone to the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Maciej is in Max Planck Institute. And Gerrit, you know. So let's look at a single interface between copper and cobalt. Cobalt grows FCC on copper and is almost perfectly lattice matched. And now the transmission matrix we're interested here, we're interested in at a perfect interface here, so if we've got translational periodicity, in scattering from a state on the Fermi surface of copper, mu, into a state, mu, on the Fermi surface of cobalt. And this is for the majority spin states. And you can represent this pretty well by a free electron model, which is what people do. What you can't represent with a free electron model is the minority spin states of cobalt, which give rise to the magnetism. So you describe a magnetism in density functional theory very well, but the price you pay for it is you get a complex electronic structure, and these are the Fermi surfaces. And we're interested in looking from scattering from this state to this state and to all other states in the minority spin structure. Okay, let's have a look at this in the case that we've got an interface now, so we've no longer full translational periodicity. The K vector is not a good quantum number, but if we have periodicity parallel to the interface, then we have conservation of transverse momentum, so K parallel is conserved. So we look not at the Fermi surface, but at projections of the Fermi surface perpendicular to the transport direction. So this is the projection. Well, there could be, but you have to have some sort of, I mean, they're included here, but if you have disorder, and I'll get onto that later, then they're included explicitly. So this is the projection in the 1-1-1 direction of this Fermi surface sheet. You recognize this, you look down this hole in the 1-1-1 direction, and this is the cobalt. It has a slightly smaller hole here. And this is for the majority spin, and this is what the transmission looks like as a function of K parallel. So what you see here is you see that pretty well everywhere where you have states in copper and in cobalt, the transmission is 1. Where you have states in copper here, but none in cobalt, the transmission is 0. Where you have no states in copper, but you do have them in cobalt, obviously, it's not defined. But that's pretty straightforward, and that follows out of a simple free electron-like model. That's not surprising. We look now at the minority spin. This is the band structure. What we have is we have the third band coming from the intersection of this band with the Fermi energy, and its projection here in the plane perpendicular to the transport direction. The fourth band here, and its projection, and the fifth band here and its projection, and we collect them all up, and this is what this picture is just a collection of all of these projections. Now, when we calculate the total transmission from the copper to this minority spin, it's completely different. So if we compare that to what we just had, this is minority, this is majority spin. So it's extremely spin dependent, and it's this spin dependence of the transmission or the reflection at an interface, which is the origin of oscillatory exchange coupling, giant magnetoresistance, junction magnetoresistance, current-induced switching, and all the other things we're interested in spintronics. Now, what we've done is we've calculated the full scattering matrix. So we have, you could just calculate conductance using the non-equilibrium Green's function, Karolyi's formalism, but we've got more information. We've gone to the trouble of calculating all of the individual scattering states. So what we can do is now we can unfold all of this, and we can look and see how a state in copper scatters into the third, fourth, fifth band of cobalt, and there you have copper into this. You have high transmission in this case. Here you see, although you have states here, you have low transmission into this state here. It's essentially zero. This is essentially one, and for the fifth band here. And this immediately tells you that matrix element effects are important. And you can look at that explicitly here. We can take a case where we go from copper into the third band, or the fourth band here at this point. So there's states available in all metals. And if we look at the character of these states here, these states are even in a plane in the YZ. Z is the transport direction, but with respect to reflection in the YZ plane. And these states here and these states have the same character, and the transmission is essentially one. Whereas if we look at the fourth band, these states here, they have odd character, and the transmission is essentially zero. So we can unravel that, and we can understand what is going on. So if you want to know it in great detail,
it's all there.
We can do that. Okay. So now I want to. This is the scattering matrix for a single interface. And now, of course, we're interested in a measurement, giant magnetoresistance. Unfortunately, okay, I don't have to explain this here, the dependence of the resistance on the orientation of the various layers in a multi-layer. What you don't do is you don't measure the transmission through a single interface experimentally. What you do is you do a measurement for a multi-layer, and it's analyzed using a generalized version of the series resistor model. Generalized to two spins, where you take a single period of this multilayer here and you interpret it in terms of a lumped resistor model. So the interface is represented by a discrete interface here, or AB, and you have a bulk-like resistivity, rho A times the thickness here and rho B times the thickness here, and the total resistance of the system for n repeats is given in terms of two interface resistances and bulk-like resistances. And this figure here, which you can't read from the Michigan State University, the only point to see is that the lines fit the measured points reasonably well, indicating that this model seems to work reasonably well. We're going to do that now. So that's exactly what I want to do. Now we want to try and express these resistances in terms of the transmission matrices we've just calculated. Now, if you just take a transmission through a single interface and you calculate the conductance and the resistances by inverting it, you have a problem. If A is equal to B, then you don't get a zero, whereas obviously there will be no resistance here. The total resistance of this conductance of this system will be the Scharfen conductance. So you have to take account of the Scharfen conductance of this system, and that's model dependent. Now you can derive a simple model where you assume that in the bulk you have sort of full isotropic scattering, and then the bulk is characterized by a number of channels, which is expressed in terms of the Scharfen conductance for the bulk here. So this is the number of channels in material A, in material B, and this is the interface conductance. Yep? We could, but this is all at the Fermi energy. This is all the elastic scattering, so in the linear response.
What I'm asking is, what is the temperature, what is the temperature?
Zero.
So you would have some spikes using the
same factor. Sure, yeah. But we can calculate the transmission as a function of energy. That's all coded. And we do it in some cases if you have tunneling magnetoresistance. One of the things we're looking at now is the effect of bias on tunneling magnetoresistance. So it can be done.
So this data from
No, they're all done with superconducting leads. Okay, so this simple form here, what you can see immediately is that the interface resistance vanishes if then you have the two materials are the same, then you have no scattering, and this trace TT dagger is nothing other than NA, which is equal to NB, and it cancels out. So now we take our transmission matrix, we put it into this formula here, and we calculate the interface resistance and compare it to experiment. So what we see here is the majority spin has a low interface resistance, and the minority spin has a large interface resistance. The calculation for the minority spin is slightly smaller than experiment. For the majority spin, it's quite larger. But this doesn't take account, but it's quite reasonable, it's in the right ballpark. These calculations don't take disorder into account, Umklapp processes, if you like. But we can do this, so we can model disorder in lateral supercells. In this particular case, we've just taken it from discussions with the Michigan State University people. We've taken it, the best guess of what these interfaces look like are two layers of alloy. And we calculate these interface potentials with something called the layer CPA. So every individual layer you can treat an alloy as a different alloy. So this is calculated self-consistently within the local density approximation. And then we see what the effect of this disorder is here. We use a supercell, a lateral supercell. You can ask what is the effect of the size of the supercell containing H atoms, so root H by root H. So this is root H, so 20 by 20 supercell. This is the conductance here, and what you see is that the majority spin conductance, it doesn't depend on the size of the supercell you use. The minority spin, it does, but you can get it down to manageable proportions. You can make it as small as you like, so it works in practice. So the effect of interface disorder here in this case was these were the values for a clean interface. This is the effect of disorder. What it does is it brings this majority spin, it increases slightly, worsens agreement with experiment, and the minority is brought into embarrassingly good agreement with experiment. We don't believe that there is a model dependence in here, but this is as good as we can expect. This is maybe almost a factor of two-thirds wrong. We can look at this in a bit more detail in this figure here, where we consider not a single interface, but a number of interfaces. So I'll blow this up. And what we've calculated here is now we've increased the number of interfaces. We've 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 interfaces here. And we calculate the incremental resistance, so the interface, the resistance of an extra interface when we just add on more interfaces. So what you see here for the minority spin case is you see essentially Ohm's law. If this is flat, you see Ohm's law, and it's obeyed pretty well. These are the range of experiments. I showed the error bar in the previous slide. I showed it was 1.84 plus or minus 0.14, but that's from a single experiment. If the different experiments done with sputter samples and E-grown samples, these are the range of experiments. Anyhow, there doesn't seem to be a problem there. What you do see for the majority spin is that it doesn't saturate until quite longer, so you don't get Ohm's law holding, and you can see this here. So we haven't taken account of bulk disorder or individual, whatever the structure of the multilayers might be. So this is a subject for further discussion. But one of the problems is we don't know what the samples look like. So this is a recurring theme. We don't know, have enough microscopic information about what the samples are like. And just a point for anybody who might be interested on the computation. This is a layer which is 7 repeats. Each repeat is 10 atomic layers of cobalt, 10 of copper. So this is 140 layers, and we have 100 atoms. This calculation is done for a 10 by 10 lateral supercell. So this is about 15,000 atoms here. Okay, so we took a 50-50. Yep.
You mentioned that you can bring into agreement some numbers, but not the others, saying when you're comparing majority to minority.
I mean, we can, well, let me just go on.
So the question is simply, what are the actual adjustable parameters and what do you adjust to?
The only thing we're adjusting, when this is what I'm going on to is now, is the what sort of disorder you have. We don't have any information or almost no information from experiment. That's all calculated self-consistently. So it's all LDA. If LDA is good, but it's for metals, it should be quite okay.
Could there be just exchange potential coming from an atom?
self-consistent is solving the Cohen-Sham equation for the full system self-consistently. So it can, yeah, sure. Well, within local density approximation, yeah. Okay, now we can, the calculations that I just showed you, they were for 50-50 alloy. And then, of course, we don't know, so we can look at it now. We can look at if what happens if we have disorder in a single layer, in two layers, in four layers, and distribute it in different ways. But now we're playing a game. This is modeling. But, okay, we need some input from experiment, or we have to do this. What you see here, this is the majority spin conductance here for all these three models. So it doesn't depend what happens, what sort of disorder you have. The scattering of these free electron-like states is so weak, you don't see any noticeable difference here in the on the error bar of things. These are the results for the minority spin case here, for one monolayer here, as a function of the concentration, where we cover the full concentration range. And obviously, if we start off here with copper cobalt and we change this, we go from beginning to the end, we end up back where we were, so we find that, obviously. You find a modest modulation here of the transmission. For two monolayers, obviously, you get less transmission. For four monolayers, now what we've done with four monolayers, we have the same number of mixed atoms, but we've taken, say, one, two, three atoms here, and we've taken one of these atoms and put it a little further away, so we've just distributed slightly differently, and it has quite a large effect. We can split then the transmission up into a diffusive part, and into a diffusive part here, and into a specular part here, but yep.
To assume that
it's all a parallel collinear. But again, something we don't know anything about. I mean, one of the things we're implementing at present is spin orbit coupling. In principle, you could try and calculate it by total energy minimization, but I don't think that's a good way to go. I mean, the total energy involved would be very small. So again,
you could just look at the effect
of spin orbit coupling, of the effect of spin disorder in a model way. That's something on the program. Okay, so now we can plug these transmissions into a resistance,
calculate the corresponding resistances.
So this is the majority spin here, and you see, I mean, the difference with the experimentally determined value is fairly small, but it seems to be outside of the error bars of the calculation. For the minority spin case, this is the range of measurements extracted from experiment, and it covers it. I think that's the best which can be said about this. Now,
it's a bit unsatisfactory,
this situation. You'd like to be able to make more detailed comparison with experiment, and from a sort of a reductionist point of view, we would like the experimentalists, I guess we can all agree on this, we'd like the experimentalists to go a simple, well-defined quantity, the transmission through a single interface. What we wanted to do is we wanted to identify a suitable system for doing this. So what we proceeded with was we looked at pairs of lattice-matched metals, and we looked at the orientation dependence of the transmission to see if there was any large effect. Because if I go back to this effect, I mean, these are the transmissions. The actual difference between the spin-up and the spin-down is still pretty small. The resistance is quite large, but the difference in the transmissions is pretty small, and experimentally you have it's difficult to disentangle them, because you do one measurement and you hope that all your systems are aligned anti-parallel, and you do a second measurement with a field applied, and you again hope that all the layers are aligned parallel, and then you use that to extract the spin dependence of the interface transmission. But it's a model dependent. Okay.
So these are the systems
we're going to look at. Non-magnetic materials, because we don't want, partly because we don't want to have to worry about the spin dependence. That makes it more difficult. So we look at aluminium, silver, aluminium, gold, which have lattice constants the same to better than 1%, and they're both FCC. Palladium, platinum, also FCC, again well matched. Tungsten, molybdenum. And then copper, cobalt, majority and minority, and iron, chromium. Okay, I don't want you to try and read all of this figure. I'll point out the most important points. These are the orientations of the interfaces. This is the Scharfen conductance of the pure metal of the leads for material A, B, and this is the interface conductance. So let me point out that the largest anisotropy in the Scharfen conductance we find for tungsten, 0.45, 0.40, and don't ask me what the units are here now. Don't embarrass me by asking me what the units are here. But this variation here is about 12.5%, small. If we look at aluminium silver, nearly free electron materials, so free electron materials, they have no anisotropy. So we find a orientation dependence of almost a factor of 2. For the largest other anisotropy is for the majority spin chromium iron, where we find a factor of 2.5. So it's comparable. Problem is that this anisotropy comes from a symmetry of the states. And if we include this order now here, what we find, so this is what this last column is here. This is the effect of this order, is it increases this very largely. So this anisotropy is quite sensitive to this order. In the case of aluminium silver, it isn't. It's modestly dependent, but there's still a large effect remaining with a 50-50 alloy interface. We can calculate the interface resistance here again, and what you find is that for the clean interface, you predict, using the same formula as I used previously, a factor of 4 for the interface resistance, and with this order, a factor of 2.5. But where does this factor of 2 come from? So what I'm showing here is, this is the Fermi surface of silver, Fermi surface of aluminium, which is trivalent. These are projections in planes perpendicular to the 111 and 100 direction, and these are the interface transmissions. And what you see here is that, be careful, this goes up to a maximum of 1, this goes to a maximum of 1.6. It doesn't matter when you add it up, it gives you a factor of 2. And what's surprising here is that for the 100 orientation, is you find a large ring which has almost zero transmission. So which I'll call a cold ring here. And what we want to do is, if we can understand this, we should be able to understand the factor of 2 in the transmission and the orientation-dependent transmission for this system here. Now, in the next figure, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the Fermi surface of aluminium, and I'm going to look at planes intersecting this Fermi surface here. One of the planes is this going to be this blue plane in this interface unit cell. And the other one is going to be perpendicular to this yellow, to the this is 111 direction, and the blue one is 100 direction. This is the 111, this is the 100. Let's look at the 100, look at these sheets. These are, then you're seeing these sheets here, these back-folded Fermi circles. In this figure here, we've added then a repeated, we've put in a repeated zone scheme, so you can see then that you have recognized the nearly free electrons, the Fermi spheres containing 3 electrons here, centered on reciprocal lattice vectors, which are also indicated here. Okay, now we're looking at transport in one direction, so if we're only interested in states with a positive velocity here, so they're all indicated by color. Blue if the transmission is low, red if the transmission is high. And what the point is that now, if we go back now to a free electron model, then of course these states here, which originate out here, this state here has a K vector further out. It is rigorously orthogonal to the state on silver, because silver in this picture is essentially a sphere. And these have different K vectors, and they don't communicate. So we expect then these states which come from downfolded from G vectors outside, we expect them to have a low transmission, and this is what we actually find. Now, so you can analyze this. These states then are going to have a low transmission. These states are going to have a low transmission. And now you can identify the origin of the cold ring here. There are simply no states along here. These states here have low transmission, and there are no states originating from a reciprocal lattice point in the transport direction here. So you can understand it. So it's the explanation is pretty simple. When you look at it, it's all textbook physics, but it's I guess most people wouldn't have expected to have the largest effect for a nearly free electron material, and in principle it should be possible to measure something like this. But it's sort of a warning if you're using simple models that the bag scattering you're getting from real materials can have significant effects, if factor of two. Okay, so that's a curiosity, no spin dependence, that's a curiosity. It would be nice if an experimentalist could go along and make an effort to measure these things, because, this is the basis for our transport. So let's look at a system of more immediate interest, which is magnetic tunnel junctions.
I don't have to explain much of this here, depending on you have a magnetic layer, you have an insulating layer, depending on the orientation of the magnetization in a free layer, this is a pinned layer, then you get a big change in the
resistance, the tunneling magnetoresistance, defined in the optimistic, because the anti-parallel conductance is small.
Definition
which most people use, being optimists, and the largest measurement, the largest measured value so far at low temperatures is for an iron cobalt magnesium oxide iron cobalt system with a TMO of about 350, measured simultaneously, or at least published simultaneously, by a Japanese group and IBM. Problem is that this was preceded by calculations predicting TMOs of tens of thousands of percent, tens of thousands of percent for clean iron, magnesium oxide iron. And an obvious question you pose is what is the effect of order alloy, in this case here, on the junction magnetoresistance? So what we're going to do is we're going to carry out a first principles study, but we're going to restrict ourselves to vacuum. Why? Because it's simple. We don't have enough information from the experimentalists on what their interface, their defects look like. Otherwise, we could do the calculation, but we don't do it, and then we're in a parameter space, and you can get anything you want out of that. The second is vacuum is relatively easy to handle. We don't have to worry about impurities scattering in the insulator, and there are experiments for this type of thing, and Dan Ralph actually talked about something which looks very like this last week. Okay, so we take iron vacuum iron to begin with. This is iron, ideal iron vacuum iron, as a function of the thickness of the vacuum. And for the majority spin state, then we find a conductance which looks pretty exponentially dependent once you get away from an asymptotic region here for closed vacuum, where you have the potential is not a square well potential. It's actually pretty curved. So that's more or less what we would expect. For the minority spin case, this is for parallel configuration here, it's not. It does end up being asymptotic, but this isn't, and I'll get back to this. But it's four orders of magnitude larger, so the conductance in the minority spin case is four orders of magnitude larger than the majority conductance. The anti-parallel is intermediate, but much smaller than the minority, so that this gives rise to the huge tunneling magnetoresistances. Here we find this is actually 20,000.
You assume that
the reflectors
are
perfect. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to get onto this. I'm going to look at the effect of roughness, alloy disorder on this. Okay, where does this come from? So this is the first thing we want to look at. There's a surface state on iron, which is well documented experimentally. This is a scanning tunneling microscopy from this group here, where they see a surface state at the Fermi energy in iron. And in calculations from the same publication here, they see a localized state here, essentially at the Fermi level here. For the minority spin case, but for the majority spin case, the same this same level here, it occurs down here. It's well below 2 eV, below the Fermi level. Okay, we can see it. Let's look at the bulk band structure of iron to start with here. And this is the band structure at the gamma bar point along the gamma H direction. And the point is there is a state with a certain symmetry, a delta 1 symmetry here, delta 1 symmetry here. But in between these dotted lines, we have something called the delta 1, the symmetry gap. So there are no states in the bulk with states of delta 1 symmetry here. Now, the same is true for the minority, but the Fermi level is up above this position here. In the minority spin case, the Fermi level here is bang in the middle of this symmetry gap. So now this is the bulk band structure, and these are now local densities of states at the gamma bar point corresponding to this direction here. And we go from the bulk out into the vacuum, and at the surface layer we find a surface state here at the Fermi level for iron in the minority spin case, which is way below the Fermi level in the case of the majority spin case. And you can see then the range of this state here. This is really localized at the surface, these states here. Okay, so what I want to do is we want to look at the effect of the surface states on the transport, and we're going to look at two distances, vacuum distances 1 and 2. And what we're going to find is that the surface states here, you've got one on each of the perfect surfaces here, they form bonding, antibonding pairs. In the case where the vacuum is thin, then this bonding, antibonding separation is large. In the case where it's the vacuum is stretched, then essentially there's very little. And these surface states, then they when you they form transmission resonances depending on this bonding, antibonding splitting. And what we find here is now, as we look at the local density states in the first case, we see this bonding, antibonding splitting here. At a thickness, a larger thickness, 8 monolayers, we see that the bonding, we can't identify it. We've put in our energies in our scattering problem, they're real energies, but we can make it, otherwise we get very sharp spikes, so we put in an imaginary part simply to broaden this, and this is what's been done here. So the splitting here is smaller than the broadening. And this is the transmission now as a function of K parallel. And what you see is that you see transmissions of order unity here. Here you have a transmission of order unity here. So, but there's a compensation here, because here you have a lower density of states as a result of this bonding-antibonding combination. Here you get a locally an increase in the transmission because there's simply a higher density of states. But eventually the region over which this happens falls off. Now the characteristic of these transmission resonance is their contribution to transport, which was proposed by these people in 2002, is that the transmission doesn't depend on the thickness up to a certain. So we have a transmission which is unity up to some sort of a critical thickness here. This is the thickness of the vacuum. And this was carried out for a model system, and we find it. We identify it. We can track these individual transmission peaks here, and we find that this is actually it is actually happening. So these transmission resonances are dominating the transport in these cases. Okay, but again, what about the effect of disorder and roughness? And we do it the same way. So let's start off with roughness here. We want to be careful. When we start adding atoms to a surface, we're changing the thickness of the vacuum. So we're mixing up two effects, and we're going to get around this in the case of 50-50 by taking half of one layer and simply moving it over onto the other. So the total number of atoms is conserved, and the average thickness of the vacuum remains the same. Now, this is what happens when we have 50-50 here, symmetric interfaces, but not perfectly symmetric, symmetric on average, is that we have, for the majority spin case, we have a modest increase in the conductance, and you probably expect that because on average there are some bits of the surface which are closer than others, and this depends exponentially on the separation. So the bits of the surface which are closer dominate the bits which are further away on average. You expect, in that simple-minded picture, you expect the conductance to increase, and it does. For the minority spin case, you get a crash of more than two orders of magnitude in the conductance here.
And which one to examine? And for the antiparallel, again, it's intermediate, it's reduced
slightly. And then the net effect, maybe I don't know if you notice it, this is majority. Minority spin conductance is reduced below that of majority for 50-50, for 50% interface coverage. And this is the TMR as a function of the thickness of vacuum here. So we see that asymptotically we get values of order 20,000%. But the effect of roughness is to quench this, in the case of 8 monolayers, to about 130%. We're down to the sort of values which experimentalists are observing.
Question. If you have this graph on the board, which says there is no dependence for a certain distance, does it also show up in these orders somehow? Because they're smaller than something, then changing?
No, this. This is for an ideal case, and these transmission resonances are quenched very effectively. I'm going to show this in the next figure by this order. Because you have a surface state which exists because you have a gap at a particular k point. But as soon as you have this order, you don't have k parallel is no longer a good quantum number, and you don't have these states become resonance states, and they rapidly become very delocalized.
So what are the typical valences?
Sorry, the typical?
Valences of the Fermi energy in the surface bus.
Valences?
Wavelengths.
Oh, wavelengths of order interatomic spacing. I showed you a band structure of cobalt. So you saw that all of the crossings of the D states, they all occur. They're all of the order. So KFs are of the order of a pi over A. So accidentally, of course, you could have a little sheet which is very close to gamma with a very large wavelength, but that doesn't happen.
No.
There
is no reconstruction, surface reconstruction, which
I mean, you see it experimentally. I showed you, you observe these with STM, so they go to a great deal of trouble to make very, very clean surfaces, and they can probe the surfaces with STM, so they can, in principle, tell you how good they are. Iron, I don't think, has a reconstruction. And as I say, you see the surface state, so that's reasonably well documented. But the interfaces are a completely different issue. There is no good probe of interfaces. Okay, now obviously we want to look at this now as a function of the surface coverage. From 0 to 50, so the points I showed you, the 50-50 points I showed you are here, but bear in mind now, we're taking a surface now and we're adding atoms to it, so we're decreasing the thickness of the vacuum on average. We've no choice in this. So these are the values I just showed you. What you see here is the very large minority spin transmission is quenched by a very small few percent surface coverage. The majority spin transmission conductance increases pretty well monotonically. These are configuration averages.
So these
calculations are all done for a 10 by 10 lateral supercell and averaged over something like 20 different configurations of this order. And anti-parallel is in between, and in fact the anti-parallel conductance, I don't know if you can see it here, the anti-parallel conductance is given to a very good approximation as the parallel up the geometric mean of the parallel conductances. But that's you can rationalize that afterwards in terms of transmission, that you can factorize the transmission in this particular case. Okay, we can look at the left-hand side here, where what happens is that up to about 25% coverage, the minority conductance decreases down here, so the TMR decreases. At this stage here, it intersects with the majority, and this relationship holds, so that they're all the same, so the TMR vanishes. And after that, the majority spin conductance continues to increase, and that decrease eventually turns around, and you get an increase in the TMR. If you look at something, the Joulier model, which is simply expressed in terms of densities of states, the Joulier model here predicts, I haven't put it in here, but it's around about here, and the Joulier model agrees with is used by the experimentalists, and it seems to explain lots of the experiments which had been done until magnesium oxide came along.
But you can find the Joulier model agreeing with you once you have a reasonable amount of disorder.
What about alloy? Now, what we're going to do is we're going to look at iron-cobalt alloy here in the leads. There's going to be a problem now, because when you start mixing cobalt in with your iron, you're doing two things. You're getting disorder, and you're increasing the number of electrons. And we want to disentangle these two effects. So what we do is we do a virtual, we define a reference configuration, which is a virtual crystal approximation here, which is a concentration averaged iron cobalt fictitious material. And this is useful. It's useful as a reference to the effect of changing number of electrons and to disentangle that from this order. But it's also useful computationally because we define a reasonable leads far away from the interface, and then we just have a region here where we have this order included explicitly. So this is the virtual crystal. So I'm going to show you some results first for this virtual crystal approximation as a function of the concentration, and then look at the effect of this order on that. Majority spin case, you can't see the difference between the virtual crystal approximation and this order. So the band structures of iron in the majority and, you have very weak scattering in this case here. In the case of minority spin, what you have is this is the virtual crystal approximation here. And what you see is then this is the effect of disorder. It's smaller than we saw in the previous case, the effect of disorder, and it only seems to be working in the low concentration range. And again, anti-parallel is intermediate. So this is the effect of changing the number of electrons. So you get a quite substantial decrease in the junction magnetoresistance as you go from iron to cobalt here. And if you include this order explicitly, then you find it's quenched. Again, to values, remember the highest value for iron, magnesium oxide iron, is of the order of 350% at low temperature, which is what you should be comparing this to. Now, so where does this come from? Well, this is very simple. These are concentrations going from, 0 to 10, from iron to cobalt. This was the transmission resonance we saw. As we increase the number of electrons, fill up the band structure, we leave this state behind. And the contribution then to this transmission decreases correspondingly. Now I have a problem. Should I stop or should I? I've got 10 minutes, I guess I can see how far I can get with this. Okay, so that's the effect of disorder on modeling, and semi-realistic modeling. I mean, it's semi-realistic in the sense that you can study it. There are quite a bit of studies of spin-dependent transport using planar electrodes doing STM-like techniques. But I think most of the physics is going to be operative in iron, magnesium oxide iron, where you do find these transmission resonances playing a role. Another topic of interest is combining. Well, most of you, I guess, are interested in how you get spins into a semiconductor here. And I don't have to explain the data DAS spin transistor. The conductance mismatch problem, which was proposed by Schmidt and Molenkamp and Van Weis. But the conductance mismatch argument, it simply says that you have, in a metal, you have a very low resistivity. In a semiconductor, you have a high resistivity. And the spin dependence in the metal doesn't matter because they're all washed out by the spin-independent resistivity in the semiconductor. This argument, it ignores the possibility of spin-dependent interface resistances. And Lawrence Molenkamp asked us, well, how large are they? Because I guess the referee wanted to know if this could be a significant effect. So we had a go at this. Within our picture here, where does this conductance mismatch, what is it? Well, these are the band structures of iron, minority, majority spin. These are the projections of the Fermi surfaces covering all of
K-space.
And for the semiconductor here, if you have a lightly doped semiconductor, of course, then you have a very small number of conductance channels. So if you have no disorder, all of this is irrelevant. You have to look at how you go from here to here or from here to here if there's no disorder. So this is going to be what could be. Symmetry effects here could play a role, and then we look at that and then the effect of disorder on that.
It's a physical point in the center of the earth.
Yeah, I think so. You see, there's a tiny, I mean, this is, okay, we worried about this, but I think we don't have to worry about it. I can't remember now which is which. If you go back through the literature, angular resolved photo emission, I think, sees this as occupied. The Haas van Alphen sees it as not occupied. And this is an argument, well, it isn't an argument, they don't refer to one another. It's been going on for decennia, and there are very high resolution experiments. They apparently can't decide whether it's occupied or not, and of course they're different experiments. Angular resolved photo emission is surface sensitive and all the rest. I don't know enough about it. We don't know. If we worry about this and we do everything as a function of energy, we just move it around. Sensitive. If something we're interested in is sensitive to these details, okay, it's unphysical or it needs to be studied in more detail. Okay, if you take an ideal interface, you look at the conductance and you do find a very large spin-dependent interface resistance, huge in fact. So this measure of the interface conductance, G up minus G down divided by the sum, is approaching 100% for an indium terminated interface and not much smaller for an arsenic terminated interface. And where does it come from? Indium arsenide, the symmetry of this state, I say everything in indium arsenide is dominated by what happens here close to gamma. You have a state of delta 1 symmetry. You have a state with the same symmetry in the majority spin in iron. But we had said it already, we have a symmetry gap here. Here is the delta 1 state in iron. These are delta 1 states. And the states here have a different symmetry, this symmetry gap. So this conductance from iron min into indium arsenide is zero, and this is large. So there is a large one. Oh, we can estimate what it is. We plug it into the formula we had before, this number, and we compare the interface conductances here we calculate using our transmissions to typical resistances in indium arsenide, assuming a doping of 10 to the 17, that's just above the Mott insulator transition, and we look at it, express it in terms of a thickness of indium arsenide, which would give resistance comparable to the interface resistance. And what you see is, depending on whether you have indium terminated or arsenic terminated, majority and minority, you need a thickness of between a micron and 200 microns to get a comparable. So it should be possible, if you could make very clean interfaces, to see this interface, spin-dependent interface resistance. But you're going to have disorder, and this is a surface of a clean semiconductor here, arsenic terminated, so the bigger balls are on top, highest up, so this is arsenic, indium arsenic, and so on. Iron nominally goes in here, is about 4% lattice mismatch. First layer of iron, second layer of iron, but of course some iron can mix and it can replace, for example, substitutionally on the arsenic side or on an interstitial side or anywhere else. If you calculate now the interface resistance, its dependence on the fraction of substituted indium or arsenic atoms here, what you find is this large interface minority resistance is quenched. In both cases, indium terminated, arsenic terminated. So a small amount of disorder is sufficient to destroy the spin asymmetry of the interface resistance. In terms of the transmission, then you go from zero transmission up to a finite transmission. But this was done for a small lateral supercell. We'd be interested, of course, in knowing what happens here. So can we identify a proportionality regime? We can. This is a larger system here. All these here, so this is minority spin case, majority doesn't depend on disorder. Minority does depend on disorder, and these are different configurations of disorder. When we have 1 in 32, one atom in our supercell, that's it. There's only one configuration. We can focus on a single impurity here. So this is a single impurity for here on a substitutional site. And now move this atom around, because we've assumed that this, so we can move it around. In the 1/8 case, this is what happens. We get a big change here. So there are states on this. Let me see. Yeah, there it is. We move this single substitutional iron atom up and down. And what you can see is that the minority spin conductance depends very sensitively on this. In the low conduct in the low concentration region, this looks very different, but it's actually almost identical to this figure if you scale it. For example, this is the conductance is increases by a factor of 4 when you go from a supercell with 8 atoms to 32 atoms and so on. This change here scales almost perfectly with this. So we're very sensitive to the concentration and configuration of impurities. One thing we asked is there anything which we can do, and I'm going to stop on time. One thing we can ask is there anything we can do to get rid of this sensitivity to disorder? So we're interested in preserving the high transmission here, in preserving the blocking here, but stopping mixing of iron with the indium arsenide. So can we put anything in between? Now, we thought about gold, because gold is essentially lattice matched, if you rotate it by root 2 to iron, and has a single delta 1 state here, which matches in this case. So let's look at what happens. We have 5 layers of gold sandwiched between our iron and indium arsenide. It preserves the conductance, the spin dependence of the conductance. As a function of energy, this is the polarization, so we go from about 100% up to, as we increase this, 20 milliEV is 17, 10 to the 17 doping, and of course as we go up larger and larger, the Fermi surface in the semiconductor goes further away, and then the symmetry breaks down, but it's still pretty high. And as a function of the thickness of gold here, for between 1 and 5 layers, nothing much is happening. And now what is the effect of disorder on this? This is with gold, this is without gold on a comparable scale. And you see that indeed gold suppresses, then it maintains then the spin selectivity. And it should be possible to, easier at least that's a suggestion for the experimentalists, then to try and grow gold on something like iron. I mean, if you grow, for example, I know that in cobalt, or gold and cobalt's multilayers, if you grow them, a very modest anneal leads to them sharpening, interface sharpening, because they don't want to mix. Gold and cobalt don't mix. I don't know what the situation with gold and iron, but you might expect the same, that instead of actually, there's a huge volume mismatch, so you might hope that when you grow gold on top of iron, a modest anneal would lead to a sharpened interface. And if gold goes into indium arsenide, well, it's a large atom, but it shouldn't do very much in there, and its effect won't be spin, shouldn't be spin dependent anyhow if it goes into indium arsenide. So, okay, so then I'll just summarize with that. I've looked at, we've developed a scheme for looking at the transport of electrons, a pretty flexible scheme with which we can study a wide range of materials. And you see the effects as soon as you're dealing with transition metals. The different electronic structures for spin up and spin down give rise to large effects. But even for simpler materials, aluminium, silver, it seems that you have to, you can't be too cavalier about the electronic structure. And the second thing, but it's no use telling you, you people know this all already, the experimentalists should work harder to tell us more about what the samples they're telling us about what they look like. Thank you very much.
Are there some urgent questions left?
The VFT will give the gap problems, so the wrong refractive mass for the indium arsenide.
No, we don't. I mean, the indium arsenide is, you have an ohmic contact. And what we've played around, the DFT actually doesn't give a gap in indium arsenide. So that's what I say. I mean, in principle, this is parameter free, but what we've done is we've added potentials on the arsenic to pull the valence band down. And we've done that in such a way that it reproduces the experimental gap in check, then it gives us the correct effective mass. It isn't very pretty, but there isn't anything better we can do. I mean, we could take a self-energy from a GW calculation, but that would be a lot of work, and I don't think you'd learn much more from it.
Okay, thank you very much.